Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Two words on every mind this week: bailout and debate. VP debate. In St. Louis, Governor Sarah Palin of Alaska turned straight to the camera and said the country needs mavericks like her and John McCain.
I think Americans are craving something new and different, and that new energy and that new commitment that's going to come with reform. I think that's why we need to send the maverick from the Senate and put him in the White House, and I'm happy to join him there.
Senator Joe Biden hammered hard for Obama and said McCain means more Bush.
The issue is, how different is John McCain's policy going to be than George Bush's? I haven't heard anything yet.
And in Washington, congressmen who said no to bailout Monday were pushed hard to vote yes. Here's Republican Zach Wamp of Tennessee.
I know who's pulling the wagon and who's really fighting to pay their bills and to feed their kids and to send them to college. And those people are now wanting us to go ahead and vote yes.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable, goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. What did you make of Biden versus Palin? Are you ready for the rescue, the bailout, the path ahead? Joining me now from Washington is Tony Blankley, columnist for The Washington Times and a visiting senior fellow in national security communications at the Heritage Foundation. Tony Blankley, welcome.
Hello.
With us from Washington as well, Margaret Taleb, correspondent for the McClatchy Newspaper's Washington Bureau. She's been covering the negotiations in Congress over the bailout and the Obama campaign this week in Detroit and Colorado. Margaret Taleb, great to have you.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be with you.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Welcome, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Tony, and Margaret.
Margaret, first to you. Sarah Palin, Joe Biden last night. What do you make of what the country saw?
I think the country was waiting to see whether she would fall on her face, and she did not. And I think perhaps the country was hoping that seeing the two of them would help them make a decision about who to vote for president. And I don't know how many minds were changed, but I think they both reflected their the top of the ticket's point of view fairly well.
Tony Blankley, you've got a conservative eye on what we saw last night. Were you happy with Sarah Palin's performance? What did you think of Joe Biden? Did you see a potential president there at the Republican rostrum if and when John McCain should need a successor?
I think yes, 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 and yes. I think what happened is that she really gave another shot of adrenaline to the Republican base. I don't think either of them are likely to persuade people to vote for the top of the ticket because of what they did or didn't do last night. And in Obama's case, he doesn't need to have an energized electorate because he is himself has energized his electorate. McCain's has been flat, and she has now twice given it adrenaline, first at the convention and again in the debate. So I think she's done a tremendous job fixing a problem that McCain has that Obama does not have.
Jack Beatty, how about it? Tony Blankley says, and I set him up for it, but yes, yes, yes. How do you see Sarah Palin, Joe Biden?
Well, I think he's right that she really did fire up the Republican base, to judge by the conservative commentariat. They're happy today. On the other hand, uncommitted voters, 2-1 for Biden and CBS. With CNN. With CBS, 46-21 uncommitted for Biden. Before the debate, according to one poll, 54% says she was not qualified to be president. After the debate, 53%. So I suppose that's some progress. But in the key group, group that she had to influence, at least these early polls say, she lost.
Sarah Palin, former TV sportscaster, the governor, turned straight to the camera in a way I've never quite seen before, ignoring Joe Biden, and launched right in. Here she is at the Washington University in St. Louis, saying Americans are fearful because of economic crisis. She framed it this way.
Go to a kid's soccer game on Saturday and turn to any parent there on the sideline and ask them, how are you feeling about the economy? And I'll bet you you're going to hear some fear in that parent's voice. Fear regarding the few investments that some of us have in the stock market. Did we just take a major hit with those investments? Fear about how are we going to afford to send our kids to college? A fear as small business owners, perhaps how we're going to borrow any money to increase inventory or hire more people. The barometer there, I think, is going to be resounding that our economy is hurting and the federal government has not provided the sound oversight that we need and that we deserve, and we need reform to that end.
Fear and time for sound oversight from the Republican vice presidential nominee Joe Biden, coming right back and saying the top of the Republican ticket, John McCain at least, out of touch.
It was two Mondays ago, John McCain said at 9 o'clock in the morning that the fundamentals of the economy were strong. 2 weeks before that, he said, George, we've made great economic progress under George Bush's policies. 9 o'clock, the economy was strong. 11 o'clock that same day, two Mondays ago, John McCain said that we have an economic crisis. That doesn't make John McCain a bad guy, but it does point out he's out of touch. Those folks on the sidelines knew that 2 months ago.
Margaret Tolliver, such different types at the on the little stage there at Washington University yesterday. Sometimes it felt like Joe Biden wasn't sure how to respond to a VP candidate who said, you know, straight to Gwen Ifill, the moderator, and to him, I may not respond to you in the way you expect. I'm going to do my own thing, and then went straight ahead to the camera and did it.
Right. Well, here's what I think has been going on. I think that for the Obama campaign and for Biden and his prep for the debate, part of the decision making has been how much does Biden interject himself and sort of try to push her into making a mistake, and versus how much does he sort of give her the slack to try to hang herself? And I think my estimation of what was happening last night was that he had decided very much really to take very calculated and fewer jabs at her, not to respond to everything she said. I mean, I think, again, with the soccer mom analogy or the soccer game Saturday analogy that she was making, on the one hand, yes, it's totally sort of populist thing people can relate to, but so what do they conclude once they're filled with fear about the economy? Who do they blame? And so far, the economy has been helping the Obama-Biden ticket.
Tony Blankley, what do you make of this, the style issue here? There's substance, but that's kind of hard to go at. Gwen Ifill, I thought, was very soft in her questioning. Sarah Palin very often just blew by the question in any case, you know, made her own decision about whether or not to answer it or go to her talking points. But on style, the straight into the camera, the kind of winking, I mean, you can see the former sportscaster here, maybe even the former, and I mean this without any disrespect, maybe even the former beauty queen a little bit in that kind of answer. Does that work for the American electorate, Tony?
Well, I mean, none of us would know what the American electorate thinks. I think that she had a lot of Reagan in her style. I remember in a presidential debate Reagan had, he was clearly playing to the audience in a pretty conscious way, whether it was in New Hampshire when he said, I paid for this microphone, Mr. Green, going off script and recognizing that this is a performance and the audience is the millions of people watching, not the few hundred that are in the room. That's, I think, perfectly legitimate if it works. I think she pulled it off quite nicely, certainly for her side, for the partisans who wanted to hear her. How she affects others, I don't know. But you can do anything you want. I mean, there are no rules other than don't get caught and don't hurt your side. And I don't think she got caught or hurt her side. So I think all the best for her on that.
Jack Beatty.
But you know, what's interesting.
Yes, Margaret.
I was going to say, what's interesting is that, you know, Biden's, when he's not in the middle of a debate, often kind of, I don't know if flirtatious is the right word, but in that same way that he tries to connect with people on a very personal level and sometimes, you know, gets very familiar in talking to voters, that's how he is on the trail as well. It just seemed that he was making a conscious decision not to let his hair down, per se, last night. But in some ways, their styles are similar.
That can be very personable. on the trail, though markedly different in the kind of structure in syntax last night. I mean, Biden sort of, as he can and often has, speaking in full sentences and paragraphs. Sarah Palin, Jack, I've got to say, some of the stretches, looking right into the camera and maybe connecting. Others I found not tipping over into Katie Couric interview style disjointedness, but almost sometimes. I mean, there were times I'm not sure I understood what she was talking about.
Yeah, she was incoherent at points, and a lot of what she said, at least according to factcheck.org and other people, was off the mark. She was regurgitating talking points, and at no point was that clearer than when Biden made this reference to the loss of his wife and child, and he knew what it was like to have to raise a child alone, and he got choked up about that. Now, frankly, I think that was real, but I also think that's very manipulative. It was a chance for her to respond with some empathy, but she was so stuck with her talking points that she went back and said, "Well, we need mavericks, we need change." I thought it was a very bad moment for her, and I think if you would just let Sarah be Sarah, she might have responded like a human being to that. But she was programmed to do what she had to do, and she did it.
Tony, do you believe that we would have here a Republican administration, McCain and Palin, that would, she really went after Wall Street greed and corruption, she said, and she said, we've got to have strong oversight and regulation. Is that really what they plan to bring to Washington?
Well, that's certainly what McCain has been saying. He's the top of the ticket. My personal taste is that I fear we're going to have too much regulation, whoever gets in. But I got to say, if you're getting into this fact-checking business, Biden made plenty of hashes. He said that we kicked Hezbollah out of Lebanon, which obviously he meant Syria, perhaps. No one's fact-checked that, but it's not true.
He also said Hezbollah's part of the government in Lebanon now, which is obviously true.
But he said that Article 1 of the Constitution creates the executive branch. Well, that's Article 1 creates the legislative branch, which he's been in for 36 years. Mm. So if you want to go and try to nitpick, you're going to be able to find plenty of mistakes that Biden made, and you're going to find mistakes that she made. And as far as scripting, I guess depending on who you're cheering for, you'll say the other one was scripted. I've done presidential debate prep, and both sides are always scripted, and the only question is how well you hide the scripting.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, another big, scary, momentous week of financial crisis, wild market swings, and the VP debate. Tony Blankley's here, Washington Times columnist, Margaret Tolliv with the McClatchy newspapers, and Jack Beatty. In the debate last night, Sarah Palin was asked by Gwen Ifill, moderator, if the financial crisis that the whole country, maybe the world, is in the middle of right now would change any of her tickets, campaign promises for new spending.
There is not, and how long have I been at this? Like 5 weeks? So there hasn't been a whole lot that I've promised except to do what is right for the American people, put government back on the side of the American people, stop the greed and corruption on Wall Street, and the rescue plan has got to include that massive oversight that Americans are expecting and deserving. And I don't believe that John McCain has made any promise that he would not be able to keep either.
Greed and corruption, massive oversight, and no promise that needs to be turned. There was a reference to Joe Biden getting emotional there after Sarah Palin had talked about the kitchen table and her family, middle-class family. She made the point repeatedly. Joe Biden saying he too, not just the governor, understood what it was like to raise a family.
The notion that somehow, because I'm a man, I don't know what it's like to raise two kids alone. I don't know what it's like to have a child you're not sure is going to make it. I understand, as well as, with all due respect, the governor or anybody else, what it's like for those people sitting around that kitchen table. And guess what? They're looking for help. They're looking for help. They're not looking for more of the same.
Not looking for more of the same, says Joe Biden. Of course, Sarah Palin suggesting she and John McCain would not be more of the same either. Mavericks, and she said it many, many times to the people of America, to the Joe Sixpacks out there. An interesting Pentecostal line. But let's hear from our listeners, Hanover, Massachusetts. Jen, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I keep hearing it, and I heard it last night in the analysis after the debate. I've never seen anything quite like it. And you said it this morning, Tom. I've seen something just like this. I saw her last night, and I saw Bush in a skirt. She kept giving generalities about what they want to do for regular people. She never gave any specific information, whereas I think Biden was very presidential, gave specifics about what he has done, what he will do, what he means when he says certain things. And I think a really great example about how she was so general is that when they touched on gay marriage. And Biden gave specific examples of how he wanted gay couples to have exactly the same rights as married couples, but said that he didn't believe in gay marriage as a government institution. And she said, "We agree." She said, I have a diverse family. I think people should be able to go into the hospital. She didn't say anything about specific policies that she thinks should be in place. And the other thing was, you know, with her continuing to say nuclear, which Bush has done in an intentional attempt to connect with that kind of base of people that don't want to see intellectuals in the office.
But Bush and a whole lot of the country, I mean a whole lot of Americans who pronounce it that way, you know, you may not like it, but it's a big chunk of the country out there. But let us pick it up. You got a great phrase there. I don't know what to make of it. But Margaret Tolliv, Bush in a skirt, says Jen when she looks at Sarah Palin.
I think I'm afraid to touch
this
that.
This is not
I'm
a
sorry.
Time for fear, Margaret. Well, I mean, there's something there in this respect, I'd say. Bush, you know, George W. Bush, unlike his father, went very clearly and unabashedly at that kind of middle of the American voting population. Didn't try to fancy up his speech. In fact, kind of fancied it down. So does Sarah Palin.
And you heard her doing that last night when she was talking about middle class regular Americans like me. I mean, most people wouldn't consider a sitting governor to be, quote, a regular person. But I think that part of Bush's legacy, you know, maybe not with certain Democrats, but overall with Republicans and with independents and some Democrats, worked. That's been a very likable thing about him, that you feel that you can relate to him, that he talks to you like a normal person. I mean, that's been a successful legacy of his administration.
Well, likable, but then the economy's in shambles. We got these wars and problems on every front. Tony Blankley, would you welcome Bush in a skirt if that's what Sarah Palin were?
No, I mean, I don't think these kind of personal descriptions are the hallmark of objectivity. It's usually partisans who use those sort of phrases. Obama is dropping the G's at the end of words.
Yes, indeed. Politicians
typically try to appeal to what they judge to be the middle class instinct, and the voters have to decide whether it's phony or whether it's a true thing. But obviously, the central strategy for the Obama campaign is to call McCain Bush 3, and if they, to the extent they succeed, they win, and they are succeeding and they are winning right now, and so that is a central message. It's not surprising that partisans, whether it's Biden or others, are going to constantly repeat that phrase and hope that it's convincing. I think that to some extent, if you're voting for a Republican, Republicans are more likely to have general policy agreements with each other than with the other party. So there's some truth to the fact that you're not electing a semi-socialist when you elect a Republican. On the other hand, as a Republican, there's probably no Republican who is less a party man than McCain, which is why those of us who are traditional Republicans have never liked him. And so I think the Maverick claim is a legitimate one, but it doesn't answer all the questions.
Jack, what about the way it's working out there? Sarah Palin talking last night about greed and corruption, massive oversight, hardly Republican bywords, but one way or the other, how's it working on the campaign trail? What do you see in the polls this week, Jack?
Well, it's been a very good week, a very good 2 weeks for Barack Obama. He is now, if you just look at states where he's 5% or over, he's at 269 electoral votes. So the worst he can do now would be a tie, which means goes to the House, which means a victory.
The worst if the polls are right.
If that's right. But a 5-point lead is, it means something. And he's doing markedly better in the battleground states. He's up by 6 there, as opposed nationally, where he's just about an average of five. So we hear that McCain has pulled out of Michigan, and Michigan looked like one state. In fact, just earlier this week, we heard Nate Silver from a polling firm say Michigan was one place, was one blue state that McCain hoped to turn. That's gone now. I think Pennsylvania is probably gone now. That was another place he wanted to turn. Now McCain is going to have to play defense in North Carolina and in Virginia and in Colorado, which is also slipping away from him. John McCain's chances are rapidly running out. Polling shows that a 5-point deficit in October. Yes, it has been made up. Ronald Reagan did it, but that's one of the rare exceptions.
Tony Blankley, do you see a bump from Sarah Palin on the stage last night that might help turn that around or not?
Well, I think it's a bump in the sense that it probably will intensify the support and maybe improve the turnout a little bit in the base. I don't know that we're going to see much there. I think that the financial crisis is sucking the oxygen out of the political campaign to the advantage of the Obama campaign. And there's almost nothing that McCain can say, and frankly, nothing much that Obama can say that's going to get a lot of traction, because the whole nation, the whole world is riveted on whether we're on the edge of an abyss. And as long as they're focusing on that, any little point you make, whether it's about taxation or environment or energy, I think just doesn't get a lot of traction, because the public, understandably, is focused on whether we have some horror story in our near future.
Yeah, it's,
that,
mm-hmm.
And so locking in an advantage, as Obama currently has, is a tremendous opportunity for him. And McCain's got enough time, if he could figure out how to get into, if the oxygen passes a little bit after the vote today or whenever the vote's going to be. If that passes, then other issues can come back. But right now, Obama's got a tremendous advantage because of that.
Here's Mike at our website, onpointradio.org. I thought Palin did exceptionally well. He writes, despite the criticism of not answering the questions and spouting slogans, I don't think Biden did better on that front. On any front, but for one, TV media set the bar very low, says Mike, which went to the benefit of Palin. Well, let's go to Waterloo, Iowa. And Karen, what do you think, Karen?
Well, thanks for taking the call, Tom. Uh-huh. Honestly, I am insulted. I am from the home of the Waterloo Blackhawks hockey team and the Waterloo Warriors. And when a woman sits and says that she's my gal, or she's six-pack Joe's gal, and she has, with her husband, a net worth of over $1 million, she's not sitting at my dinner table. I know very few, if any, soccer moms or six-pack Joes who have that kind of financial security in the bank. So I think that before she likens herself to those folks need to be educated as to who she really is.
Well,
thanks for taking the call.
Karen, thank you very much. I guess maybe having seen the Charlie Gibson interview with the plane in the lake out back and the great view of the mountains, it looks like Fat City to Karen, however it comes across at the debate. Let's go to Bloomfield, Connecticut, and Naomi. Naomi, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I had a couple reactions to last night's debate. I was looking to see if I thought vice presidential candidates could think analytically.
Mm-hmm.
So I figure the presidency is a job where you can't know everything before you go in
mm-hmm.
to lead the government. And I think Sarah Palin did not think analytically. She winked and smiled a lot, but I could not imagine her in a serious conversation to settle the issues in Darfur or to figure out how we're going to deal with our environmental problems of not enough water, or selling an international treaty, those kinds of things.
But what about another aspect of leadership? I don't know, Naomi. Maybe that reaching out through the camera and connecting to people, if that's what she was doing. Maybe she did her analysis in advance and decided that was the most important thing she could do last night.
Well, but I didn't think she was an analytical thinker. And I have to tell you, I'm a partisan because I'm a Democrat, and I plan to vote for Barack Obama. But I also believe that there is a possibility that the McCain-Palin ticket could win. So I ask myself, if she were a Democrat, would I vote for her? Somebody who answered a health care question by just saying yes and then going back to the talking points when we have such serious problems with health care in this country? And I said, no, if she were a Democrat, I would not vote for her.
Naomi, we've got it. Margaret Talev, Margaret says, doesn't look to her like Palin thinks analytically. Now, at some level, a very important level, that would be important, whether she's VP or potentially one day president. But in the campaign, Is her presentation a problem or an advantage?
Boy, I mean, that's tough. She's not as polished or as experienced in this sort of format as Joe Biden or as John McCain. And, you know, I think that shows. I also think if you put your average member of the House of Representatives up there for a debate with, you know, a week or two's worth of prep, they'd probably do a comparable job. I don't know what her ability is like behind the scenes to be analytical. I think when you have a camera on you and a tremendous amount of pressure and advisors saying you can't screw this up and, you know, some of the folks in the base of your party calling for your head, it adds... I mean, I understand if you were actually the president or the vice president, you'd be under a lot of pressure every day also. So I get that. But I don't know if a debate is the best real test of whether a person has the private ability to be analytical.
Mm. Here's a question, again, from the moderator, Gwen Ifill. Pretty soft, pretty loose on the questions. But she asked here to Governor Palin where she drew the line, in looking at the commander-in-chief role, where she would draw the line on the possible use of nuclear weapons.
Governor, on another issue, interventionism, nuclear weapons. What should be the trigger, or should there be a trigger, when nuclear weapons use is ever put into play?
Nuclear weaponry, of course, would be the be-all, end-all of just too many people and too many parts of our planet, so those dangerous regimes, again, cannot be allowed to acquire nuclear weapons, period. Our nuclear weaponry here in the U.S. is used as a deterrent, and that's a safe, stable way to use nuclear weaponry.
Sarah Palin making her way through a little bit of nuclear strategy questioning there. Tony Blankley, Jack Beatty looks at the polls and sees a tough challenge from McCain. McCain acknowledging something large this week in Michigan, withdrawing or sort of wrapping the campaign there, at least for now. How do you interpret what you see in the polls on the electoral map at this point, Tony?
Well, I agree. Obviously, it's a big event. October is the month when campaigns start making these very hard decisions. I believe a week ago, Obama pulled out of one of the Dakotas. I forget which one. I've been in campaigns, and you start making these nasty decisions where you start cutting off money to certain states because you're not competitive there, and you go put money elsewhere. I don't doubt that looking at Obama getting stronger in Florida, the McCain people have to bet that they'd rather spend their money securing Florida rather than trying on an errand to carry Michigan. And these are the kind of decisions you have to make. And it bodes better for Obama because you reduce the number of opportunities that McCain has. He's still got Wisconsin, Minnesota, Pennsylvania, and maybe New Hampshire in blue states that he can claim. But he is getting defensive in Virginia and North Carolina and Florida and Colorado and New Mexico, the old states that were carried by Bush. So the map begins to, it's not decisive yet, but it's beginning to close in on McCain, I would say.
Let's get a call from Des Moines, Iowa, and Joel. Joel, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say, I thought Sarah did great last night. What a fresh perspective from somebody that's not been inside Washington for 30-plus years.
And would you be happy to see her at John McCain's right hand or happy to see her in the Oval Office if events required that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know what? She doesn't have all the answers, but does anybody?
And
Obama has all the answers, or you know,
right?
We don't have all the answers.
Well, what about the idea that she's Bush in a skirt? We heard her from a caller earlier. What do you think of that, Joel?
I think that's a biased statement from an Obama supporter.
But I mean, would you expect very different policies from Sarah Palin and John McCain from President Bush or not?
Yes, I would, actually.
Like what?
Well, she wants to downsize government instead of grow it. That point really stuck with me.
Yeah, a lot of people looking at that right now. Jack Beatty, of course, and we'll come to this, but right now on Capitol Hill talking about a bailout, which I don't know about the size of government, but in terms of paying for it, it certainly wouldn't cover that mark very well, and both sides are supporting that right now.
They are. And, you know, there's an aspect to this, Tom, that I think needs to be noted. Conservative commentators from Laura Ingraham to Neil Cavuto, Mike Huckabee, Michelle Malkin, Charles Krauthammer, they are now blaming essentially minorities for this crisis. They're blaming something called the 1977 Community Reinvestment Act, which required banks to lend to people in the communities they serve. They're blaming this crisis, the subprime crisis, on this program. In other words, it was an excessive regulation favorable to minorities that brought about this program. That's wrong on facts, and it's poisonous socially.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. More from Tina Fey as Sarah Palin this week, plus late night's take on the Veep debate and a new strategy to get out the vote. On last weekend, Saturday Night Live, Katie Couric, played by Amy Poehler, had hard questions for Sarah Palin, once again played by Tina Fey.
Forgive me, Mrs. Palin, but it seems to me that when cornered, you become increasingly adorable. Is that fair to say?
I don't know. Is it?
Okay, David Letterman said the debate last night had lots of highlights.
One thing about it that I really loved, there was I loved the back and forth arguing both sides of the issues, and that was just Joe Biden.
Yeah, he was talking to himself.
And a new internet video features famous faces, including Leonardo DiCaprio, Natalie Portman, Jamie Foxx, Halle Berry, using some reverse psychology to encourage young people to register to vote.
Don't vote.
It's a bad idea.
You don't have to.
Who cares about global warming and the fact that
our polar ice caps are melting?
I hear polar bears can swim. I forbid you to vote. Stay where you are.
Don't vote.
I hear polar bears can swim. We're looking at a big week in the news with Tony Blankley, columnist for the Washington Times, McClatchy Newspaper's Washington correspondent Margaret Talev, and our own Jack Beatty. Let's go to Steve in Westerly, Rhode Island. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hello. May I call you Tom?
Yes, you may. May I call you Joe? You're on,
right,
Steve.
I'm very disappointed by progressives and Democrats during this whole discussion of the bailout. They're letting the same people that frightened them into agreeing to the Gulf, to the war in Iraq, frighten them into an unprecedented level of trickle-down economics. Where's the Democrat that stands up and says, what could be more trickle-down than borrowing $700 billion from the next generation and giving it to Wall Street banks? And no one's talking about that. No one's talking about alternative ways of stimulating the economy or resolving the problems in the financial markets. And when you look at the mainstream media and the publications that we turn to for thoughtful analysis, they've all frozen in their tracks. It's as though there's more of a freezing of intellectual capital than there is of financial capital.
Steve, let us pick that up, and I'll turn to Margaret Talev. I've got a little bit of tape here first from, this is Wednesday morning, an interview on NBC's Today Show with Ann Curry, before the Senate passed the bailout bill. But when the Senate was in there, you know, adding on new elements to sweeten it up, the House Majority Leader, Democrat Steny Hoyer, said he was unhappy with some of the additions to the bill, especially those so-called sweeteners.
There's no doubt the tax package is very controversial. The Senate, in my opinion, is adding that on because they think that's the only way they can get it passed.
It's going to cause you to lose Democrats.
It may. We're going to have to be talking to them. I'm not particularly pleased with that addition myself.
In a debate this morning in the U.S. House of Representatives, Republican Mike Pence of Indiana said that he still opposed the bailout.
I did not come to Washington to ask working Americans to subsidize the bad decisions of corporate America. Therefore, I cannot support the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act. While this bill promises to bring near-term stability to our financial turmoil, I ask my countrymen, at what price?
Margaret Talev, you've been there on Capitol Hill watching Congress wrestle with this. Give us a sense of how the two parties are talking about this among themselves, you know, how they're rallying and not rallying, have rallied and not rallied to this bill, bailout.
Well, there's two or three camps within, you know, both the House, both the Republican and the Democratic sides of the House. There are folks locked in really tight reelection bids who have been waiting for public opinion to come around and give them enough cover to vote for it if they're so inclined to do it. There are the ideological, economically ideological folks on both sides, both the Republicans like Mike Pence who are, very opposed to government intervention and government spending, and the liberal Democrats, who are all for government spending, but they think it should go, you know, straight to the little guy and not to Wall Street first. And then there are sort of the moderate forces in the middle of both parties who think, well, I'm not crazy about this and I think it's hard to sell, but they really think it probably is, in the short term, what needs to be done to shore things up. So these guys are all, you know, swimming around in this sea of sort of confusion and election fear. It's a terrible time to try to push something like this through Congress a month before this pivotal election. Republicans are poised to lose a lot of ground. Democrats, you know, to some degree, the freshman Democrats who have to stand for reelection are put in a difficult position. It's terrible timing to try to get something like this done.
Tony Blankley, what do you think of the package at week's end and the sweeteners that the Senate brought to it, another $150 billion in tax breaks for individuals and businesses? What do you think of the whole, Tony?
Well, I must say I'm sort of amused with the phrase sweetener in a $700 billion bill. I mean, it's like, how do you sweeten a cup of sugar? What do you put in? It's already sweet.
Saccharin on the sugar.
But I was interested in what the previous caller said, because I took it that he was a liberal complaining that liberals weren't standing up to Wall Street lies or whatever. And the funny thing is that overwhelmingly the people who are standing up are conservatives, you know, particularly in the House of Representatives and also a number of conservative Republican senators.
Having spoken against it, you're saying.
Well, against it, yeah, against it, precisely because they don't want to bail out Wall Street. And so it's sort of a fascinating moment where the left side of the equation in Congress is keeping quieter than the right side. Both of them oppose it, but it seems the right side is more willing to stand up and shout, and the left side is not giving as much, at least vocal, opposition as one might have expected, because obviously both left and right have grievances. The package itself is dubious, but we've got to the point now where the whole world is waiting to see whether Washington can act. And so my view is, you know, we have to act and pass this thing, whether or not it's going to do substantially the objectives. I think a lot of economists have their doubts as to whether it's going to solve even the short and medium term credit problem, but it probably won't hurt it, and failure would create a banana republic look to Washington. So I think we do have to pass it.
Jack, as we sit here talking right now, the House still debating. By the time some of our listeners hear this, that they will have made their decision. But the economy keeps speaking. 159, nearly 160,000 jobs lost in September. Employers slashing payrolls. That's a big cut. The economy is talking very loudly behind the Congress here.
It is, and I want to identify myself with Steve's comments that this is a progressive failure. One of the differences between our moment and the 1930s is, yes, the New Deal was not rehearsed during the 1932 campaign, but all of the what became the New Deal had been rehearsed over 25 years of progressive politics. They had not had a chance to do these things. Now they had their chance. The difference today is the Democratic Party doesn't have a program. Its program under Bill Clinton really was the same sort of deregulation that led us into this crisis. You can't just be blamed on the Republicans. And just as under the Republicans, campaign financing drove it. Congressmen, Democrats too, were bought out and relaxed regulation for the price. And the Democrats have no coherent, there is no coherent progressive response, because that whole tradition has withered. And Obama is going to have to create it, if he can, when he's in the White House. And the possibility that the public could listen to something like that hasn't been higher in decades, because they recognize that Reaganism is over. That experience has tried and proven it to be a failure. You cannot have relaxed regulation and have this sort of thing. You cannot have trickle down, because it doesn't trickle down. The public is waiting. They're ahead of the politicians, but we haven't yet heard that progressive response.
Margaret Tolliff, you've been out talking with voters in Colorado, in Michigan, in Detroit. What do you think? Is Reaganism over? Has the public view of the economy, turned that far so far?
It varies a little bit state to state. And I think in Michigan, I mean, in a sense, this was sort of a nail in the coffin for the it being worthwhile for McCain to stay there and to try to pick up that state. In Michigan, where the unemployment rate's the highest in the country, it's like around 9% or something like that. when I was there, I sensed a lot of frustration from people. Like, you know, they've been doggy paddling, you know, for safety for years now, and Wall Street gets a bailout. I think in other places, like in Colorado, there seemed to be more confusion than anything else. I think this issue, the issue of the Wall Street crisis, tends to help Obama more than McCain, but I think that's more pronounced in different places. And I think in Florida, where foreclosure is a huge issue, this has probably helped propel Obama to the lead. And as Tony was talking about earlier, I think that all the buildup about the vice presidential debate has sort of obscured this really important development this week, Obama's apparent moving ahead in Florida. I mean, that is huge, huge news. And that could absolutely be what tips the election. It's also put the issue of race on the back burner because the economy is so much on the front burner. And Obama's biggest impediment in some of those sort of Rust Belt states, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and to some extent Florida, has been this subterranean issue of race. Mm-hmm. And it's just not being talked about as much anymore because the economy is so dominant.
Overshadowed, overawed maybe by the economy. Margaret, what about the McCain and Palin ticket? When you're talking with voters, I mean, there was the debate people were waiting for last night after you were out there. But still, how were they seeing her? How were they seeing John McCain and the message that he's the maverick who will turn around what's been wrought in Washington?
Most undecided voters who I talk to don't identify him primarily as the maverick so much as they identify him primarily as the more experienced candidate. And I think for him, until this economic crisis, that was, you know, really very effective. In terms of Sarah Palin, I didn't talk to many independent voters, for whom she is a net positive anymore. But I did find some women in Colorado who like her very much, identify with her, even some Democratic women who were former Hillary Clinton fans and aren't totally on board with Obama. But for the most part, I think Palin's performance last night probably helped solidify Republican support. I don't know that it did much for independents who are leaning more toward Obama in recent days.
Let's go to Hartford, Connecticut, and Dan. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Pretty well.
I think it's really important that this bailout not go through. And I think that the fact that it's been pushed through by so much of the media and both Democratic and Republican candidates, I think we're really seeing brutal extortion going through here. Basically, people are being told, if you don't support this bailout of the people who screwed up the economy, we're going to destroy your entire way of life. You know, you're not going to be able to get student loans. You're not going to be able to buy a car. You're not going to get paid at work. And basically, I think we're seeing more than just the default on Reaganism. People are not just looking at Reaganism fail. People are looking at the actual financial system of this country fail. Because basically, investors aren't investing unless they get a profit. And the fact of the matter is, we don't need to make profits to do things like save people from hurricanes or produce productive things. I think that.
Well, but profits pay a lot of dividends and are behind a lot of salaries and bring resources that, if well mustered, could certainly help a lot of folks on a hurricane aftermath.
The fact of the matter was, we had like whole fleets of Greyhound buses that could have saved people in Hurricane Katrina, but because Greyhound buses couldn't make a profit off of saving people, they didn't save them. There was a thousand or so people died, and there basically there are entire public housing projects that are being bulldozed to make way for far more profitable Disneyland type setups in New Orleans.
Yeah.
There's still people all over the country who haven't gotten home yet.
Dan, we hear it. It sounds like you may be one of those ready for a little Reaganism is over message. Let's hear from the Republican Minority Whip Roy Blunt of Missouri, saying outside the House chamber this morning that he's optimistic about the bailout bill's chances, wouldn't predict the number of GOP voters that would switch their votes to support the bill, but he did say there were now some good items in the bill.
The FDIC insurance coverage, plus the addition of tax legislation that almost all of our members would be supporting if it was standing alone. So we're optimistic that we'll go to the floor today.
Republican Whip Roy Blunt of Missouri this morning on Capitol Hill. Let's get a call from Nashua, New Hampshire. And Paul, you're on the air, Paul.
Yes, can I call you Tom?
Okay, sure.
I have two questions concerning this rescue plan. First one is, does anybody really know what the valuations are, given the fact, especially that the SEC has proposed relaxing the fair value rule.
You mean, in other words, what price they're going to pay for these bad or pretty bad mortgage assets?
Under the reverse auction. But the thing is that they may be allowing people to, or the banks and the debt holders, I guess we should say, allow them to either mark to model or mark to value.
Yeah, mark to market and all the rest. Let us pick it up. Margaret Talev, what about it? That power to price these bad assets has an awful lot to do with how much capital the banks would have on the other side of this bailout. Now, it started out entirely in that three-page document that Hank Paulson set up, entirely in his hands. Would it still be there after this 400-plus page document that's before the House today? If that goes through, does Hank Paulson have the same sort of solo power to decide?
I don't want to get in over my head here, and I'm afraid I'm about to, but I think the Treasury Secretary Paulson and then his successor, will have a lot of leeway as to how this works. There will be some oversight and some input, but so it's not entirely unfettered. But, yeah, I mean, this is a crisis, and they're authorizing, the Treasury Secretary with the ability to handle the crisis.
If I could hop in here,
Tony,
just
please.
For a second. Really, even when you put aside all the sweeteners and the stuff, the mm-hmm. basic concept that was proposed a couple of weeks ago in three pages still remains. It's going to be about $700 billion. Mm-hmm. The Secretary of Treasury is going to be able to pay more than current market value mm-hmm. for these toxic bonds, mortgage-backed bonds. And they're going to take them off the market and hope that over the years they'll be able to put them back on the market and sell them at a better price than they're worth now. That's the guts mm-hmm. of the plan for the federal government, the taxpayers, to overpay. And what the Treasury can do is that they can borrow. We don't have any money, of course, because mm-hmm. we're already in a $500 billion a year deficit before this.
Right.
All that happens is the Treasury can come in and borrow the money from people who are willing to loan the money at a lower rate than anybody else can. And that's what they're going to do. They're going to borrow money at the lowest possible rate, buy up these bonds at a higher than market value, hope to allow the banks then to know precisely what they're worth so that people will start doing business with them, including other banks, and thus loosen up the freezing of credit which is going on.
Jack, we've just got a couple seconds, but you get the feeling people are going to look back on these days years from now as a real hinge moment in our country's history. Decisions being made right now, big echoes coming.
And decisions that are going to shape the next presidency, whoever wins.
Mm. Jack Beattie, Margaret Talev, Tony Blankley, wonderful having each of you with us here today. Tony with the Washington Times, Margaret with McClatchy's Washington Bureau. And Jack, thanks for joining us. Have a good weekend, everybody. Let's come back with clear heads and take it all on again next week. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.